Coming up on Weekend America.
You see the telltale signs, like on garbage day, when you start seeing furniture piled up really high, that's usually, you know, that's usually a good indication, because you can tell people are just pissed and mad and upset or whatever, and they're just throwing stuff out.
Before this financial mess, there were foreclosures.
Do you know what foreclosure means?
Not living in a house.
Do you have friends at school who have foreclosures?
Some friends.
In one Las Vegas neighborhood, you can open a window and see the crisis. I'm John Moe. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, Levittown was created as an all-white planned suburban community.
I just like the landscape and the people. The people, and it's very diverse. People of different background, racial background, and, you know, it's a melting pot. A little United Nation.
50 years sure can change a place. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, that was an exciting week in a strange and terrifying sort of way. Not every week that the term $700 billion gets tossed around, but the weekend is here. So take a break. The madness will resume soon enough. This hour, we'll bring you the peculiar story of Reggie Prim, former child singing star in Israel, now coming to terms with his past in America. Plus, secret entree to a decades-old jam session, and a look at how a planned suburban community from the 50s is holding up today. What says suburb to you?
Westchester. Oak Park.
Huntington. Glen Ellen. Plano.
To my mind, a thing that makes a suburb is it not being walkable.
I don't really like suburbs. You know, I really hate suburbs, as a matter of fact.
The houses are really far apart. It's just a giant parking lot.
Chain shopping.
Nah, definitely away from the strip malls. I mean, that's the real blight of the suburbs. Maybe the tranquility and, you know, getting away from the city.
They just bring to mind bland, vanilla, everything the same.
Did you grow up in the suburbs?
No, I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
Those voices came from Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, St. Petersburg, Florida, and Washington, D.C. And not, I believe, from any suburb, because then maybe they'd like suburbs more. Well, Congress is in session this weekend trying to come to an agreement on a massive and expensive bailout measure for Wall Street. The crisis was much discussed in the first presidential debate Friday, even though that debate was supposed to be all about foreign policy. The crisis has dominated the news this week. Of course, much of the week's turmoil has its roots in the subprime mortgage crisis and the collapsing housing market. Residents of Las Vegas know that all too well. The whole city has been hit hard. Property values have plummeted, and the area has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. Things are especially dire in the newer parts of the city, recently built subdivisions like the gated community of San Nicolo. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark has been keeping an eye on this community, and she's been bringing us updates on how this example of the housing boom has been holding up during the housing bust. She went back to San Nicolo recently, and here's what she found.
There are newspapers, websites, radio, and TV stations you can turn to for the latest in the country's foreclosure crisis.
Oh, Karen, you've got the letter. Let's open up the letter.
Yeah. But in San Nicolo, the news often comes straight to the mailbox in a personalized letter. It might not be in the language you speak.
Compañía, you get to hear my bad Spanish.
But you'll probably get the gist.
It's urgent. You call us.
Contact us right away.
And it's hard to escape what some words mean.
Oh, geez. Foreclosure.
Like the ones in bold.
I know enough Spanish to read urgente and foreclosure.
The woman reading this letter didn't want to use her real name, partly because the letter she's reading isn't actually addressed to her, and of course it's against the law to read someone else's mail. She didn't mean to. 2 days before, Veronica, that's what I'll call her, was going through her mail and opened a letter she quickly realized was meant for her landlord. But she'd already read enough to discover that the house her family lives in, the house she's been promptly paying rent on for the last 2 years, is in foreclosure. Her landlord hadn't told her.
It was one of these bad dreams where you kept flipping over the envelope and looking to see, is there a mistake? Please don't let this be happening to me. I can't believe it's happening to me.
Veronica has come over to her neighbor Karen Lewis's house for a little moral support while she reels at the implications of this letter.
Do you want some water?
with us? Veronica is a single mom. She recently got laid off from her job as a project manager for a company that provides retail software for department stores. Now, besides finding a new job, she'll have to find somewhere to live, fast. Her friend Karen leans up from fixing one of her son's toys to offer one possibility.
Worst case, you can come across the street and stay with me.
Still, Veronica's worried she'll probably have to move out of the neighborhood, and then her kids might have to transfer to new schools. She just started housing two Obama campaign workers in a spare bedroom for the election. What will she tell them? But shocked as Veronica and her neighbor are by the letter she's just read, it only confirms what they already know about the subdivision they live in. That reality can be summarized neatly with some pages Veronica printed out last night from a website that tracks foreclosures in Las Vegas.
Look at all of the ones on Arcata Point. This is our street. Look at this. Look at that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. One street and this one subdivision.
Perfect storm is a cliche that gets thrown around a lot these days to explain the collapse of the housing market in Las Vegas and other parts of the country right now. A warm front of booming home construction and runaway real estate speculation hit a cold front of unscrupulous mortgage lending practices, and bam. This perfect storm, you might say it's been hovering right over the red tile roofs and desert-hued stucco of Veronica and Karen's gated community.
We've seen how many families move out now?
Quite a few.
You see the telltale signs, like on garbage day when you start seeing furniture piled up really high. That's usually, you know, that's usually a good indication because you can tell people are just pissed or mad and upset or whatever, and they're just throwing stuff out. One of the owners on the corner actually took a picture of it. They literally threw garbage all on the ground, and it stayed there for 2 weeks solid. And then their sprinklers were coming on, and it was getting wet, and just it was just so bad.
When people leave, do they ever say goodbye, or do you ever say goodbye to them?
No, they're just gone.
San Nicolo has been feeling the effects of the real estate crisis for more than a year now. A lot of houses are vacant post-foreclosure. Others are being rented out to college kids or multiple families by investors who'd hoped to flip the properties for a quick profit but couldn't find buyers. Houses that had gone for $600,000 are now on the market for half that. And the neighbors say the wrought iron gate that was supposed to symbolize prestige and security is regularly rammed by tow trucks trying to get in to repossess residents' cars. Vandalism has become a problem in the neighborhood. Break-ins, slashed tires, broken windshields. A few months back, this all worried Veronica and Karen. Now?
It becomes comical. I mean, this is completely laughable to us right now. That's all we can do. We used to get upset about this, and we were a bit appalled. And now it's like, oh, whatever, guys. Come on in.
Just don't rob me, okay?
Karen's 4-year-old son, Cooper, likes to go on walks with his mom around the neighborhood, and I go with them to see what's happened to San Nicolo since I was here last spring. Some things have gotten better. The banks have sold a few of the properties they'd foreclosed on, so some of the dry lawns we saw last spring have new grass and new owners. But the foreclosures keep coming. Now there's a new batch of houses with signs in front that say bank-owned.
Nobody's living in that one anymore.
With the sale sign? I think you're right.
That one too.
And walking around the neighborhood, Cooper is starting to learn words that are not on your typical pre-K vocabulary list.
Do you know what foreclosure means?
Not living in a house.
Do you have friends at school who have foreclosures?
Some friends.
We pass a house a little further down the street. Karen's surprised to see that it looks vacant, too. She sees a guy getting out of a pool maintenance truck in the driveway.
Is this house... Do you know what happened to the people here?
They moved.
They didn't?
Right now.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. Bank-owned home. Do you know how long it's been?
Probably a while. It's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad?
Pool's pretty bad. It's been sitting for a long time, so...
Wow.
At least 2 months, 3 months, probably.
That's another thing about San Nicolo these days. There's so much turnover that the people who know the place best aren't the residents, but those who serve them. The pool guys. The landscapers.
Hello, and thank you for calling the foreclosure hotline.
Alessandro Chiacchetti is the real estate agent behind the Las Vegas Foreclosure Hotline.
Did you know that nowadays you can buy a house for about 40% less what was going for just 1 year ago?
I saw a handwritten sign advertising his service as I was driving out of the airport when I flew into town. He's put up signs all over the city.
I come up with the idea, you know, that's called, you know, Italian creativity, you know.
In the soft housing market, it's been hard for realtors like Alessandro to make a living, but he's adapted. He's become a specialist in helping his customers climb through the many, many hoops involved in buying a bank-owned house. He says about half his customers come from outside the U.S.
They have many Canadians, you know. Canadian dollar is very strong, and honestly, they find our prices quite ridiculous.
Turn right on Southern Highlands Parkway, then turn right on Bargetto Court.
Alessandro is driving me around San Nicolo to give me a buyer's eye view of the neighborhood. We drive past several foreclosed houses that are now vacant, but we don't stop.
It can be dangerous when you go and show a vacant home.
They break in the house, homeless people, they spend the night over there.
Let me just park here. Just...
Instead, we go to Mike Hager's house.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Hold on, let me get Michael.
The tape's a little quiet there, but when we arrived, a young boy, Mike's grandson, opened the door and yelled, "They're here to take away our house."
Hey, Michael, how are you doing?
Boxes are stacked in their foyer. In the front yard, there's a pile of books, pots, old magazines, a pair of slippers.
Just stuff. Yeah, it's all the giveaway stuff. All the various things we've accumulated through the years.
Mike and his family are moving out this weekend. Their house is about to be foreclosed. They had to stop making payments about a year ago when Mike's own real estate business went under. To avoid completely ruining his credit history, Mike's worked out a deal with the bank to let him short sell the place. That means before the bank takes ownership, he's trying to sell it at a loss. Mike says he has three genuine offers on the house, almost $300,000 less than he paid for it 3 years ago. But still, offers that the bank will consider. He's hoping one will go through. Just in case, he and his family are moving into a rental unit across town this weekend, while their credit is still good enough to get a landlord to lease to them.
Smaller house, but hey, it's all about, you know, having family together. You know, just keep family together, so.
How are your kids doing? How are they feeling about it?
Well, they're fine. As far as, we just tell them, hey, you can either look at the bad things or you can look at the good things. And I just look at the good things and say, hey, you know.
So what are the good things? What are the good things right now?
Tomorrow's another day, and I'm very thankful for the time I had in this house. And just don't get cynical over it, you know. So
Mike is moving on. He would say goodbye to his neighbors, but most of them are already gone. Others, like Veronica, the woman whose landlord is being foreclosed on, will be out of the neighborhood soon. The thing that's striking about Veronica and Mike and a lot of the people I talk to here is that as they describe their situations, they are not altogether out of hope. They can even find moments for laughter, or at least a half a smile, along with the shake of the head. In Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
You can hear other stories of life behind the gates of San Nicolo and see some pictures from Chrissy's trip there at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
Shipped off to Israel at age 4, Reggie became a child singing sensation. Years later, he listens back and tries to make sense of what happened. Next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Here's a fundamental challenge of adulthood: making sense of what happened in childhood. Taking those memories, figuring out what really occurred, and seeing how to move forward from there. You're listening to The Tonistics, a band singing about Dimona, Israel, in this particular song. It's a spiritual capital for a group called the Black Hebrews. The group originated in Chicago, but many members of the group moved to Israel in the early 1970s. One of the voices in this particular track is that of Reggie Prim. He sang with the group as a kid. Now he lives in Minneapolis. The Tonistics' music was re-released this summer, but Reggie had never really sought it out. As Jews prepare to observe Rosh Hashanah this week, Desiree Cooper got Reggie to agree to listen back to some of those songs. We're going to hear two stories here, actually, Reggie's and his mother's. Here's Desiree.
Reggie's journey to Israel began in the early 70s when he was about four. His mom, Edwina, was living near Detroit, a divorced mother of two, and a friend introduced her to the Black Hebrews. They talked about self-sufficiency, building a perfect society in the land of milk and honey. She was hooked.
I hadn't been circumcised, and in order to go to Israel at the time, I had to be. And I'll tell you, at 4 years old, boy, you remember that. That was a painful experience, but also a very frightening experience, and just one that to this day sort of took a little bit of the trust out of me to experience
that. Trust in that. What?
Well, trust in people that you think are meant to care for you.
One day in 1973, she gathered at the airport with 100 other Black Hebrews. But at the last minute, Edwina turned to Reggie, who was still just a toddler, and his 11-year-old sister. She told them, get on the plane. She wasn't going.
I'm about to enter the airplane, and it was like, okay, honey, go ahead. Bye-bye. Yeah. She sent both of us, my sister and I, went to Israel before my mother.
She followed soon after, but until then, he lived in total uncertainty.
So you arrive in Israel. Where did you end up living?
Well, we went to Dimona, which is a small town in southern Israel, in the Negev Desert. It's famously the city where the Israelis built their atomic bomb.
For them, Dimona, Israel, was not the land of milk and honey. Reggie's sister began to fit in, but not Reggie.
There were all kinds of new rules. They were strictly vegan, and some days you could eat salt, some days you couldn't eat salt. You had to wear clothing that went all the way down to the ground. It had to have, like, blue fringe on the side. You had to have your hair covered. Men didn't shave. Women were separated. There was, you know, some malnutrition with children. There was some food shortages in the community.
His mom became a seamstress for the group, and Reggie was homeschooled. Years later, when he was about nine, he woke up one day, and his mother was gone. Just like that. Vanished. He went all over the city trying to find her. Weeks later, he found out she'd gone to Indiana.
I think soon after that, decided that if she could get to the United States, I could do it too.
Were you expecting her to send for you?
Yeah, I never thought she'd come for me. I thought, I gotta figure this out. I gotta find her.
Every time he ran away, someone always found him and sent him back.
And so the first time it was okay, you know, they were like, oh, you know, why did you run away? And then the second time, you know, the punishments became more and more intense. There was incidents of abuse.
He was miserable. Once, after getting caught in Tel Aviv, they put him in a bomb shelter.
I'd get up on the bench, look through these holes in the door. I would see this band, and they rehearsed every night, hours and hours. And so I would have, you know, time to just stand there and look through the door and watch, you know.
Reggie was captivated. He auditioned, and he got into the Tonistics. It was the happiest he'd been since he was four.
So the Tonistics were kind of modeled on the Jackson 5.
And let me guess, you were Michael.
Well, I was Michael in the sense that I had a really high voice. I could do the I'll Be There and, you know, and could do the dancing like James Brown and do the spinning and all that stuff and, you know, be a little cute dancing machine. So.
What's it like listening to that now?
Well, yeah, the memories are kind of flooding back in and... That's me. Okay. My heart's kind of racing. That's kind of really...
Why is your heart racing?
Well, that's the first time I've heard that voice, my childhood voice, in almost 30 years. I thought that music was lost, and wow.
Even though he was in the band, he never lost sight of his goal to escape. In 1984, he finally made it to the American Embassy in Tel Aviv, and within weeks, he was on a plane to Indiana. His mom and other family members were there to greet him, and they hugged, exchanged just a few words, and then they went to McDonald's. They've been pretty close ever since. But Reggie still has a million questions. Like, why would a mother send her children alone to Israel in the first place?
They looked to get my ticket. It wasn't there, and planes were ready to go, and they just got on the planes and went. So there wasn't a moment to mourn or anything. It just happened. And I trusted the people that they were going with. They might have been blind, but I had trust.
Edwina remembers a lot of things differently than Reggie. She doesn't talk about why she had to leave Israel so suddenly, but she said she'd been saving money to return when she got that call from Reggie at the embassy. And she said she didn't know that he was being abused. His letters to her were censored. And she even wonders if he was overreacting.
I don't know what he did. Well, he acted like a boy. And he broke the rules. And they were strict on the rules. Well, I had never punished him. So I think he felt his spirit was broken, but I don't know. I was telling Reggie when he was here over Labor Day, my mother and father worked away from home all the time. And what little guidance I had was from my grandmother as a guardian, you know. And I told him, if you feel that you weren't parented by me to your expectations, that may be true, because I could only parent you to what I knew about parenting.
How do you feel about your mother now?
I love my mom dearly. I admire her very deeply for the courage that it took to actually take that leap of faith, and it didn't come without cost.
What does it mean to you now when you listen to that music?
Well, you know, even though there's all this darkness, all this struggle that this community is going through, in some respects, their highest aspiration is encapsulated in that music. And it didn't come without a cost. Music and art and human expression often, you know, are born out of human suffering and struggle. And so it's very, it renews my faith. I think it's beautiful.
This is Desiree Cooper for Weekend America.
This weekend, Reggie will be attending an art and democracy conference and celebrating his 40th birthday. He's no longer part of the Black Hebrews, doesn't practice Judaism at all. These days, he's a community organizer in Minneapolis. He does go to Indiana regularly to visit his mom. Edwina Prim is still connected with the Black Hebrews and travels back to Dimona to visit her daughter and grandchildren.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle. And is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
Levittown, New Jersey was originally an all-white suburb. 50 years later, it's not all white, and it's not called Levittown either. Ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. By now, we know a lot about what Barack Obama and John McCain think are the important issues in this election. They've been explaining those beliefs for a long time in speeches, ads, emails, all over the place. Even a debate that actually did take place this week, even when it looked like it might not for a while. We have heard from the candidates. But maybe we thought here on the weekend, there's a way to think more broadly about some of the issues facing our country, hear from some other people. So we've asked some writers and thinkers to talk about what they believe should be on voters' minds as the ballots are cast. Our essay today comes from Iraq war veteran and poet Brian Turner.
In Iraq, I was an infantry team leader with the 3rd Striker Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division, from 2003 to 2004. Over the course of a year, my platoon conducted a wide range of missions, from raids to convoy escort to simply patrolling the streets on foot. And there's one incident I'd like to share today that happened early on, in December of 2003, at the firebase where we lived, just off the Tigris River and near the town of Balad, which is not too far north of Baghdad. I was manning the front gate when a minivan pulled up after nightfall. The van's interior light illuminated a dim scene. Inside, 3 guys were frantically talking and trying to help someone I couldn't see. I called up one of our translators and soon realized that these Iraqis had come to us seeking medical attention. Their friend had been shot and seriously wounded at a nearby American checkpoint. And no matter how much I wanted to help them, when I called up for guidance, I was ordered to refer them to the local hospital. I remember the van as it pulled away. One of the men inside stared at me for a moment then, his hands covered in another man's blood. Nearly 5 years have passed, and we've entered the last leg of this presidential election. It disturbs me that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are rarely a part of our national dialogue. If we do not see or hear of the war in news reports, that doesn't mean it's all basically over and ready to be written into a history book somewhere. Believe me, there are 10-year-old children in Iraq and Afghanistan who know what war is, and will never rid it from their heads. And we now have a responsibility to them. We have a responsibility to help the millions of Iraqis fleeing the war as refugees. It's a national embarrassment that Sweden has sheltered far, far more Iraqis than we have ourselves, and with little help from us. Because we invaded Iraq, we have a responsibility to those who have died there, as well as those who have been wounded or psychologically traumatized. Just as Ted Koppel once read the names of the brave Americans who sacrificed their lives in this war, we must one day read out the roll call of the Iraqi dead. And that list is incredibly long. Of the studies done so far, even the very lowest figure for the death toll in Iraq is a number which staggers the imagination. We have a responsibility to respect the sovereign government of Iraq and to follow their guidelines for a timely and smartly conducted withdrawal. We also have a responsibility to our own soldiers and to those living in these war zones to discuss the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan without boiling the conversation down into simplified phrases like winning the war. There is no winning here, only gradations of loss and the great need to begin the slow process of healing and rebuilding. This isn't a football game where we cheer only for our team. Voters need to force the real issues and ensure that the candidates, as well as those who support them, confront the deep and difficult questions we have before us. In terms of Iraq and Afghanistan, I want to know, what will they do specifically to help the wounded veterans we now have returning home? What will they do to aid the countries of Iraq and Afghanistan in their efforts to rebuild and chart a new course for themselves? If we shirk these responsibilities, our moral standing among the community of nations will rightfully slip in the world, even further than it has already. I don't want our nation to feel as I felt that night in Iraq, nearly 5 years ago, when the wounded came to me for help and I turned them away.
You can find a link to more of Brian Turner's writing on our website. And while you're there, join the conversation online. That's at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In St. Paul, I'm John Moe. This weekend, the residents of Willingboro, New Jersey, are throwing a semi-formal banquet to celebrate the town's 50th anniversary. But Willingboro hasn't been called Willingboro for all of those 50 years. It used to be Levittown, a name of note to anyone who's followed the history of suburbs in America. This was the third Levittown after similar planned communities in New York and Pennsylvania. The name isn't the only thing that's changed. What started in 1958 as an all-white town on the edge of the Philadelphia suburbs is now a diverse community of people from all over the world. Reporter Joel Rose takes a look at how this iconic post-war suburb has fared in the last half century.
Willingboro Township, New Jersey, was mostly woods and farmland when Levitt and Sons moved their operation here. Starting in the summer of 1958, the company built 11,000 houses in exactly three different styles: colonial, ranch, and Cape Cod.
These homes were model homes. There's a rancher, there's a cape, there's a rancher there, there's a cape.
Harry McFarland used to run the town's recreation department. On a recent weekend, he led a trolley tour of Willingboro, a.k.a. Levittown, in honor of the town's anniversary. Most of the folks on the trolley were residents, and most were African American. That's both an accurate reflection of Willingboro today and a sign of how much things have changed.
Of course, Levittown was at the beginning lily white.
Herbert Gans is professor emeritus at Columbia University. Gans was a grad student in sociology when he bought a house in the shiny new post-war suburb. He later wrote about the experience in his book, The Levittowners.
They were raising families. You know, a lot of them lived in either with their parents or in the neighborhoods of their parents before they had a child. So they just had to get out. Levittown was sort of the most widely known brand name. It was also probably the cheapest.
This is no mere collection of homes, but a carefully planned community, complete with modern schools, playgrounds that leave nothing to be desired.
That pitch appealed to Doris McSweeney.
When my husband and I saw this model, we said this was the house we wanted. And I tell you, even though it was as cheap as it was, when we were signing those papers, our hands were shaking. Oh, we're going to be able to make the payments.
McSweeney's husband was in the Navy, stationed in Philadelphia. The McSweeneys had four young kids when they moved to Levittown. She still lives in the same three-bedroom colonial they bought in October of 1958.
Levitt came along at a time when families needed homes for their kids. It's just a great place to live. We never locked a door. Our kids came in and out. Just was a perfect planned town, I think.
And planned to be 100% Caucasian. Sociologist Herbert Gans says William Levitt deliberately excluded blacks from his third Levittown.
In Levittown, Pennsylvania, there had been a race riot. A black family had moved in and nobody got seriously hurt, but it was pretty nasty. So he wanted by all means to avoid that because, of course, it had gotten to the press and it made Levittown, PA look bad, made him look bad, made it harder to sell his houses.
But Levitt's policy was on a collision course with state law and a man named William James Sr.
I was an officer stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey. My wife and I decided that we would try to find a home to live in.
James was trying to buy a house near Fort Dix around the same time Levittown opened its doors. He'd faced a lot of discrimination, but none as overt as William Levitt's.
I'd been to other places, but they would be cordial and everything, but you never heard from them again. He was the only one who told me that they were not selling homes to blacks.
James knew that was technically illegal in New Jersey, so he sued Levitt and Sons. 2 years and several appeals later, the New Jersey Supreme Court sided with James, and he picked out a house in Levittown.
He had to sell it to us. He had no choice.
James lived in Levittown until 1974. By then, lots of things had changed. In 1963, the residents voted to switch the name back to Willingboro. And the demographics continued to change. During the 1970s and 80s, Doris McSweeney watched as most of her white neighbors packed up and left.
Willingboro just got such a bad name, and it's a shame. It really is a shame. And a lot of the people moved out because the black people moved in. And I always felt that if they had the money to afford the houses, they deserved to live. They wanted their kids to go to good schools, as we did.
What we were looking for was a place where the kids could grow up, schools weren't far,
you know, that they, you know, could grow up in a healthy environment.
I met Carol Newman on the historical trolley tour of Willingboro. Newman and her husband moved here from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania in 1973 and raised three kids. At first, Newman says they were thrilled with the schools, the parks, and the swimming pools. But she says the schools have gone downhill, and she finds it all
sad. They used to have events where the community would come together. That's all gone. The pool that every park had, the pools are not there, or they're there but not functioning.
These days, Willingboro is changing again, and the newest arrivals are coming from a lot farther away than Pennsylvania.
I fell in love with Willingboro the first time I saw it. And since then, since 1995, I'm still having fun with Willingboro.
Johnson Kolawole is the head of the Greater Willingboro Association, basically the Chamber of Commerce. Kolawole was born in Nigeria, though he moved here from South Carolina in 1995. He says other immigrants are arriving directly in Willingboro from Liberia, Asia, and the Middle East.
People of different background, racial background, you know, it's a melting pot. A little United Nation, so to speak.
Some of the town's newest residents are sending their kids to an elementary school named after William James Sr., who fought to integrate Willingboro 50 years ago. James spoke at the rededication a few years back.
What was it like to see all the kids of all different colors and shapes and sizes?
It was an excellent experience. Not in my wildest dreams that I ever think that I would have a school named after me, because I went to a segregated school all my life.
James says he's especially proud that his granddaughter is a student at the school. In Willingboro, New Jersey, I'm Joel Rose for Weekend America.
So that's how Levittown has changed over the years. Many of the issues that that suburb is dealing with are also common to other suburbs as well. Issues like energy use, infrastructure, development. To find out where suburbs stand today, I spoke to Dolores Hayden. She's a professor of architecture, urbanism, and American studies at Yale University. And I asked her about her evaluation of the original Levittowns.
I think that the Levitt communities were overhyped as ideal communities. In fact, Levitt was making money as fast as he could. He was subdividing farmland for the most part and building identical houses with very little thought about public space or public infrastructure. He built swimming pools that got a certain amount of public press. But after that, he did very, very little for these communities, which were urban-scale communities. So there was a great deal of community effort to make these towns into places where people shared a sense of rearing their children and coming to terms with post-war life together.
There was a phrase in the story we just heard, carefully planned communities. It sounds like these aren't really all that carefully planned.
The Levittowns were not carefully planned communities. To my mind, they're following the pattern of scatteration. Geographers would call the building of clusters of single-family houses in farmers' fields, scatteration, or sometimes they call it pepperoni pizza city. You know, it doesn't make any sense. There's a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit somewhere else. And every time this happens, if it's not happening according to a plan that regulates growth, there's more demand for public infrastructure.
So what is the lesson of Levittown?
I think that the buyer should beware in every case that the sales pitch will perhaps be an extremely appealing sales pitch, but buyers should really be thinking very hard about just exactly what kind of house they're getting for the money. And the Levittown in Long Island, which was the first one Levitt built, in fact, they managed to build for 80,000 people without any sewers. So the community was spending the next 15 years or so figuring out how they were going to bail that place out pretty literally, and the federal government had to come in and provide more grants to support what hadn't been done by the developer in the first place and would have been standard engineering policy had they been in an urban setting. So I think buyers should be very, very careful.
Where are people moving? Where is the trend right now? Into the cities or out to the suburbs?
I think that for the last 30 years, I've heard people say that surely, surely people are coming back to the city. They have seen some of the difficulties of suburban life and they're coming back to the city. And every 10 years, it proves not to be true. You know, some of the fastest growing places in America are on the suburban fringes. So while you may know people who choose to live in the city, that's not the predominant trend.
Read the fine print, caveat emptor.
Every time.
Do an
every
inspection.
Time.
Dolores Hayden from Yale University, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I hate to tell you this, but we're not out of the woods yet with tropical storms. Kyle is out in the Atlantic and heading for the East Coast, gathering strength. But there is still fun to be had across America. Here's Stephanie Curtis.
You see a highway, Marlinton, West Virginia sees a buffet. They host the West Virginia Roadkill Cookoff, where all dishes involve something found on the side of the road. 65 degrees as showers create a sauté for delicacies like biscuits and squirrel gravy and bear teriyaki. Marlinton, West Virginia, where your bumper is a major kitchen appliance. Peaceful Valley Orchards is a nice place, but inaccurately named. This farm in Pittstown, New Jersey, is the site of the Flying Pumpkin Festival, as pumpkins are tossed by catapult, trebuchet, and other devices for distance, power, and just because it's cool. 73 degrees and rain of both the water and pumpkin varieties. This is how the Saxons defeated the Visigoths in the Great Pumpkin War of 682. Honest. The people gather in Idaho, in the Sun Valley part of Idaho. They honor Ernest Hemingway. He was an author who used to live there. They call the event Hemingway Festival, and they gather and talk about Hemingway and be together and think and use run-on sentences or short sentences. The sun goes down, but the sun also rises, 73 degrees. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org with a little bit of weather everywhere. I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
Get into this one mysterious 21-year-old jam session, you have to find a secret door. We found the door. Jam out next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Going to hear some live music this weekend. Find a band you like, go watch them play, hear lots of songs. Okay, well, this next story is also about music being performed, but it's the complete opposite of your traditional concert-going experience. It's about a group of musicians, but they have no name, and they're not really a band. They play music, but not really songs. They don't play for audiences, just for themselves, and to even find where they are, well, there's a hidden entrance. Reporter Sandon Totten explains.
Going to the Friday night jam feels like something out of an old spy film. You hear about it through word of mouth. You go to the back of an old apartment building after dark, and then you ring an unmarked doorbell.
Hey, how's it going, man?
What's going on?
Have things gotten started yet?
Hell yeah, it's rocking.
That's Patrick Conrad, a lanky 22-year-old with a scraggly goatee. He takes me down a flight of stairs toward the music. There's no signs or advertising because the jam isn't about gathering an audience. It's for the musicians. Before Patrick became a regular here, he played in an AC/DC cover band in a small town in Iowa. But on a trip to Minnesota, he discovered the jam, and he's never been the same.
Yeah, it's the whole reason I'm living in Minneapolis right now. I came here for the jam, trying to start a band, and that's not happening. But, you know, the jam goes on every week. Can't beat that.
We're in the basement of an old Polish Catholic school. And if the nuns could see it now, I doubt they'd approve. There's a circle of guys sitting around, sucking on cigarettes, drinking beers. They're waiting for inspiration, or at least for a good buzz, before they start playing. Patrick's probably the youngest in the room by at least 10 years. Most of the musicians are in their 30s or 40s. They dress like rockers, in t-shirts and jeans, but there's also a few receding hairlines and beer bellies in the crowd. On the other side of the basement, there's a studio full of instruments. A drummer and a guitarist are getting things started. It may take a while, but they've got all night. At the jam, you could be working with seasoned pros or total beginners, but as long as you're willing to groove, no one cares how you play. Anything goes. Well, almost anything.
There's only one rule, and that's the two guitar limit.
That's Rick Lee, and this is his studio.
Because guitars, they get real thick. They're very chordy, and they can get very loud, and they're always will all turn up to 11. And if you have 11 guitars turning up to 11, what is that? I don't know. What's 11 times 11? Well, that's what it got to be sometimes.
Rick started the jam 21 years ago. He was in a band, and they couldn't decide how to spend their time.
And we were frustrated because some people would go, let's just jam. And other people would go, let's rehearse and get it tight.
So they compromised. One night a week for serious rehearsal.
And then we'd come on a Friday night and just forget about all of that stuff and just let loose.
2 decades later, that band is history, but the jam is going strong. Rick's a carpenter by trade. He built the studio for the jam. On Friday nights, he plays both host and the jam's unofficial roadie. He plugs in microphones and amplifiers for other musicians. Rick says it takes a while to get things going, but when it finally does get going, the jam shreds. The musicians are smiling, shouting, riffing, slamming, strumming. Following the action makes you dizzy. 1 minute, it's the guy on saxophone. Next, it's the dude wailing away on the clarinet. Then, someone appears out of nowhere with bagpipes.
You know, after a while, when things start clicking, there's nothing like it, you know?
That's Del Royster. He's tossing out fat jazz riffs on his guitar. Todd O'Donohue is on the drums, pounding away with a serene smile on his face.
For me, it's great practice on my essential self. If you get your personality, your head, or anything in your mind in the way of the jam, you could get stuck on something and not go with the flow. And how am I going to capture the magic of the truth of right now? I mean, it's such a fleeting thing.
You can't hit a wrong note.
That's Bill Hill. He's tearing into a solo on a Fender Stratocaster.
There's no such thing as a wrong note down at the jam. It's incredibly liberating.
This goes on for hours. There's no real end to the songs they play. They just kind of ebb and flow from one movement to the next. It's 2 a.m. now, and things are getting a little weird. This part of the night isn't for everyone. But for someone like Patrick, the guy who moved to Minneapolis just for the jam, that's the point.
You know, music doesn't have to be what MTV tells you music has to be, or what Columbia Records tells you it has to be.
Patrick wants to start an avant-garde rock group, but he says it's hard to find venues, fans, or even bandmates who share his vision.
This is the only thing I have. I got a crummy job, pays me $8 an hour. When I come home at night, I'm either reading a book solo or playing guitar solo. You know, this is the only interactive thing I have to live with, you know, where I actually come and play off of other people, you know.
At 3 a.m., Rick calls the jam done. Patrick packs up his stuff, drops off a few empty beer bottles in the recycling bin, and then heads out into the night alone. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, I'm Sandon Totten for Weekend America.
We have photographic evidence that this jam exists. Even you don't have to go down that secret entrance. You don't have to find the hidden door because you can just go to our website. It's like Bigfoot. We have proof, but the pictures aren't as blurry. Go to weekendamerica.org. Well, so much for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of this entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's also available at iTunes. That way you can take the weekend with you, even when it's Tuesday, even when it's a rainy Wednesday afternoon, and you think, when will the weekend ever get here? You just go to the computer, you go to the iPod, you fire up the Weekend America, you enjoy the weekend, you have a sort of a virtual weekend experience. Hey, I heard a joke this week. Listener Reed Banneker of Seattle sent this along. What's brown and sticky? A stick. Okay, well, do you have a better joke than that? Send it to me. That's it for Weekend America for this hour. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, travel to 1968, where a theater full of zombies and a theater full of kids was not an ideal combination.
Little children were running up and down the aisles. Then as it progressed, you saw them get quieter and quieter, until they were crying and hiding under their seats.
The premiere of Night of the Living Dead. Join us.